the A&M Club. I'm Andrew Whipple.
I'm Alex Wade.
And here we are, a lovely after work recording. We haven't done one of these in a while, and usually they tend to be a little loopier because we have to like think about things for a full day on like a usual Sunday.
It's also got that Monday sort of blues, you know, the crushing realization that you have a full week ahead of you.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth? A couple of working boys here. But actually, somewhat tangential, what we are going to talk about is not anything specifically related to our jobs. In fact, do not represent our employers, blah, 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 whatever, whatever, et cetera, boilerplate. But we do both work in the technology industry, and that has gotten us thinking about this episode's question, which is, what do we think is going to be the next big thing in tech? If there even is a big thing. Next big thing in tech. Dun, dun, dun.
Definitely going to be Snapchat face filters. That is, you know, what's hip, what's cool right now. Although, actually, that is something that is
fascinating. It is pretty hip and cool. It's pretty hip and cool. Kids are into it.
That is something that is happening right now. There is specifically a filter that came out recently. This is already a tangent off of what the introduction is supposed to be. But
of course, both of them.
There is a filter that is out right now that is like AI textured or something. So it's a basically a Beautify filter that the other filters, you can kind of tell they're a little bit fake. And like if you move your hand in front of your face or if you talk, you can tell a little bit. It's like just on the side of the uncanny valley that you can tell that they're slightly fake. But this new one is insane and is just on the other side of the uncanny valley and is going to be dangerous. And like if you put your hand on your face, it doesn't mess up the filter at all. It's scary.
That's wild. Okay. I had heard some rumblings about some like AI filter stuff, but that's
what it does. I haven't done a whole lot of research to it, but what I heard it does is like it recalculates in real time all of the different textures on your face or something based off of AI something. Saying that out loud made me realize that I know nothing about it, but it's using some new technology or something.
Two software developers. Let's go.
Exactly. I do front end. Okay.
Yeah. I just like, what do? I write things to let people log in. The one class that I didn't fail or I didn't flunk out of, but I did drop because I could tell I would flunk out of it, was a like AI machine learning probabilistic graphical models class. And I was like, nope, not for me.
If statements, right? Just if else statements.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But yeah, I think in thinking about this topic, it's definitely been something that's sort of been more front of mind for me for the last couple of months and looking at various different news stories about whatnot in the tech industry. But it does seem like something that's sort of been bubbling for the last like 2-3 years, especially sort of during some of the pandemic craziness in the tech industry and tech valuations and whatnot. But a lot of people talking about XYZ thing being the like, this is going to be the next big thing in the tech industry. This is going to be some new paradigm shift that will change the way that we think about tech for at least a decade, if not forever. And there's a few of them in particular that I think come to mind that we can talk about in more detail. But that general, there does seem to be a general vibe that people think that we are at the precipice of some shift. And there's a few different options where people have staked their claim for what that shift might be. And I don't know, it seems like a fun thing to discuss. And even when we've talked about various like technical and scientific topics, we haven't really done as much talking about like the industry and the sort of the reality of the stuff that we work in.
Yeah. And I think there's an interesting difference. There's like the hype that media does for a lot of these things. And then there's like the reality of what has changed due to these specific things over the course of the years, you know, like, for example, blockchain. I definitely think it has affected the world and it has made an impact, but it is not the new iPhone, you know, like it has very specific useful use cases that exist for blockchains, but it is, you know, not the reinvention of the internet. It is not, I don't know, the printing press, right? And I also, I guess that's my a question I have for you kind of in that regard to go, like, what would you say are some other big things that have happened in the past, like 10, 15 years to kind of categorize those? I mean, there are obvious ones, but are there like less obvious ones?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've also been trying to think of. There's a writer that I follow and subscribe to, Ben Thompson, who does the Stratechery blog. And he's done a lot of writing on different elements of this. And so he's definitely someone that like probably colors a lot of my thinking on it. But I think a couple framings that I've seen discussed, and I think I more or less agree with, is there's one version of it that's sort of saying that, like, thinking about how do people interact with computing devices of, like, in the 60s or 70s or whatever, it was big mainframe computers that are in universities and in defense labs, and then personal computers are, I don't know the actual time, 70s, 80s, I don't know.
Sure.
And then, like, 90s, 2000s, internet and browsers start to be more of a like, oh, you're interacting with computing stuff via the internet. iPhone in particular comes out. Mobile becomes like sort of the big way that you interact with technology. And each one of those sort of create new big giant companies that are sort of like, if you have the IBM era versus the Microsoft era versus the Google era versus the Apple era, for instance.
Yeah.
Another one that is sort of more internet focused, and I think will come up when we talk about like blockchain, if we wanted to talk a little bit more about blockchain stuff in more detail, there's the like Web 1 is, it's a bunch of static sites that are linked by hyperlinks, and it's very much that like blogging and GeoCities and 90s and early 2000s. Google, even to a lesser extent, is still just like it's a page with a bunch of links version of the internet. Web 2 being defined as that, like, what if instead of static, it's dynamic? What if instead of you host your own websites, you're operating on a platform full of user-generated content? And that's sort of the like Facebook dominant version of the internet. But the only other one that I was kind of I'm curious about is there does seem to be in the 2010s in particular a shift from a lot of the big companies that make a lot of money and get a lot of funding being ones that are very like consumer focused stuff. So like your Googles, your Apples, your Facebooks and whatnot, into stuff that like there does seem to be a rise of this cloud and software as a service as a new area of like viable funded technology companies. But that feels a little bit less. If that is influential, it's sort of stealth influential in comparison to like the iPhone or in comparison to like
It's very influential platforms. I think business to business wise is cloud services and that sort of thing. But that's not something that's like, I don't know, that's so consumer. Yeah, that's not something that's consumer facing, and that's hard to quantify. I'd say it is something that has easily greased the wheels for new companies to be able to spring up and to get to speed. But that's hard to, I don't know. It's like the invention of money sort of thing of like, it makes things easier, but that's hard to quantify.
Yeah.
I guess. No, I don't know if that's an appropriate metaphor, but sure.
And I do also wonder, this is sort of getting forward looking, but how in thinking about what is coming next in terms of thinking about what has happened, looking at the 2010s and the 2010s rise of like all of these business to business software as a service companies. So things like Slack, things like Figma, things like companies that are provided. Whereas before you have to like buy a static piece of software that gets updated every year and you pay for a new version, or you host a thing yourself. Instead, now you pay a company to do all that for you and you get the software delivered to you over the internet via cloud services. Since so much of those are like Figma being a design tool that is a multi-billion dollar company, their primary customers are other companies and probably other companies that are also using other cloud services. And so like the wheels being greased in that way that you're talking about is a potentially self-fulfilling prophecy. But I do wonder how much of that is that like, well, if all of these B2B software as a service companies, their main customers are other B2B software as a service companies, and then interest rates dry up. Is that thing going to be a thing that was a step in a evolution?
Sure.
Or is stuff like cloud going to be a thing that greased the wheels in a crazy 10-year period that then is a blip and an aberration, even if it is a dominant model in that 10 years? Unlike, I think, mobile pretty solidly is like, the toothpaste not going back in the tube on, are we going to go back to like desktop computers?
Yeah, I guess cloud, like the reduction in future cloud computing, I guess, is what you're possibly theorizing about.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess maybe the other one potentially in terms of like things that might have been pivot points going back, I don't know when you would point it to, but like the rise of venture capital as the dominant funding model for for technology companies, which is not, that's how most of the famous companies are founded or funded. Venture capital, someone comes in, you know, puts in a whole bunch of money with the expectation of like one out of their 100 companies that they invest will succeed, and it'll succeed very wildly, and that will pay off for all the other ones that fail. It is a model that is well suited to software companies, where if your thing works, then you can basically scale it more or less infinitely forever, and you can get 100x return on an initial investment in a way that you can't if it's like a physical product. But like, I don't know, there's other ways that you could fund.
It's an interesting strategy. That was my brother. He has like a, I don't know if a phrase or a joke that he talks about how venture capitalism, the majority of it is just like the method for disseminating wealth to from rich people to less rich people, because like, MoviePass, for example, you know, is just, when it first came out, was just straight up like, we are giving money to people basically in the form of movies for $10 a month or whatever.
I mean, so is Uber for much of Uber's existence, that like, all right, we're going to subsidize, we're going to take SoftBank's money and turn it into free or cheap taxi rides for millennials.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I know food services or food delivery services in the past year or two, I never banked in on this because I didn't have the patience to do this. But like, I know there were at least in New York City alone, five different new food service companies that you would like, we're going to give you $100 off for your first orders and only pay $10 in like a delivery fee, which like you could have just gotten like, you know, $500 to $600 of free groceries by going through all of these different startups.
100%.
And just not going back to them.
Yeah. This is a side rant that may or may not fit in depending on how the rest of the conversation goes. But what does seem to me to be the craziest thing of the 2010s that I think everyone will look back on being like, this is just fundamentally insane, is like, you do have some, there are some companies where my theory is that a lot of it has to do with seeing Google, Amazon, and Facebook and the way that they scaled through like just reinvest aggressively in growth. We'll figure out the money later. And then they do basically have the ability to turn on a money spigot at some point of like Google adding ads in search, Facebook obviously adding ads in the product, Amazon, like the way they make money now is through ads, AWS, and Prime. And then they run the retail business at like still either break even or a loss. But thinking that the lesson of that is, oh, if you have a tech company, you can scale for growth, target growth, and then the money will come later in a way that is true if your social, if your thing is be a search engine, where once you get to be the best search engine and everyone uses you, you can monetize that and it gives you infinite money. Same thing with a social network. Same thing with a like, especially in Amazon's case, where it's like once you've built the warehouse, you get economies of scale from that. Blah blah blah. And then even more so now that they've pivoted into ads and AWS as the way they make their real money. That is not true of a taxi company, and that is not true of a delivery company. Where it's like, okay, now that you've grown, like the only way Uber could have grown into, like if Uber gets a bunch of people using it, and then what do they do to turn the money spigot on? Do they like raise prices? Do they invent self-driving cars? Like there's no end state for that.
Is Uber not profitable?
I think they might finally be starting to get there recently.
Okay. Yeah, because you're talking about how they're not like doing that. I don't know. The tone that I feel like you're taking is like, oh, they're fucked.
No, but I think it's the what I think it is, like WeWork, actually, another good example is that WeWork is a perfectly reasonable business model of like, you basically arbitrage taking long-term leases for cheap from these people that own the buildings, and then you sell more expensive short-term leases that are more flexible to people, and then you make money off of that. Like, perfectly reasonable business. It's just, it's not a tech business that you can Facebook scale by just like, okay, if we like pour a bunch of money in it and grow, eventually we'll be able to turn on, get 100x return on this. It's like, no, you will be able to get 1 to 2x return because it's a reasonable business, not a crazy internet business. So there are some also kinds of internet businesses that that model works for, but like offices and taxis and food delivery are not those kinds of businesses.
And I think there's also something to be said. Oh, just that idea of like, oh, scaling to some extreme measure and then adding ads or something, right?
Yeah.
Which like I watch Twitch, a lot of Twitch, and I have seen it over the years become what it is now. And like, there used to be like 1 15-second ad an hour, maybe, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And now it's just inundated with ads all the time. I don't know. I'm gonna turn this conversation into more anti-capitalist rant, but like, how do we get past that? Because that's the model of all of these companies, right? Is to make their through anti-competitive practices make their product ubiquitous, and then ejection. It's the Walmart model, right? Of run everyone out of town and then jack up prices and then leave. Except, they don't have to leave anymore. And like, I mean, I guess maybe the answer is regulation or socialism, but like,
challenging part that this is me fully just cribbing from Ben Thompson and Sir Thackeray, that his view, which I think I mostly agree with, is that there is sort of a special, or the internet makes things interesting in that in the Walmart case, it's like you're geographically limited. So like once Walmart comes into town, Walmart is able to get like an actual geographic monopoly over an area and price out the they price out the other competitors, and the competitors leave, and then you're at that point where it's like, well, yeah, there is truly nowhere else I can go to because I was priced out. On the internet, that's not totally true, where like there's a virtuous cycle on a Google or a Facebook or something like that, where it's like, once you get all the websites, then your search engine is better, which means more websites want to be on your search engine, which means more users are going to use it, which means more websites want to be there, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Same thing for Facebook. But at the same time, it is genuinely true, unlike a geographical monopoly, that like you can go to Bing. There's nothing stopping a user from doing it other than Bing will be worse. Or they have a muscle memory, or it's the default on iPhones or whatever. And that sort of like leads to an interesting quirk that like doesn't fit existing antitrust. It's unlike an existing antitrust stuff where the expectation is like, if you can control a scarce resource like geography, or like you own the railroads or you own the cable that it's really expensive to put in the ground, and then you get your monopoly, and then you can do terrible things with that. In the internet case, it is you still have to provide the best user experience, even if that user experience gets worse over time. It still is like, if there was something better than Twitch, or had the people that you like watching on Twitch, then you would probably switch to that. There's nothing like actually keeping you there other than Twitch is worse than it was before, but is the best place still to watch the kind of stuff you want to watch. And so that's a really tricky antitrust problem to solve, where it's like, what do you do about that?
No.
Or how do you craft regulation around that, I guess, is a better way.
And no, in the specific instance that you gave of Twitch, I would disagree, because they do sign exclusive contracts. So like, I can only watch Hasan Abi on Twitch.
Okay.
I can't watch some of the other content creators on other sites.
That's a fair point.
I understand what you're saying. I guess you're not saying that it's like, it's I think I've probably said this before of like the what tech does is it finds ways around laws and makes it ungovernable almost. And it's very difficult to create antitrust laws. As you're saying, creating antitrust laws around these very clearly monopolies.
Yeah, I think two different elements of it. One, which is the very tiny thing, and this is not in the case of Google, because Google is a monopoly in search, I think, by any reasonable definition. The other, but when these are very clearly monopolies, like Amazon, I think, is about 30%, between 30 and 50% of e-commerce goes through Amazon, which is like big, but also very much not a monopoly. Same thing with like social networking of like Facebook is big, but it's not a monopoly. So tiny little thing on that, which is like, even then think about like, okay, well, how do we say that like, okay, well, what we thought of as monopolies now doesn't make sense because there is this new thing that is big enough that it's important, but it's too small to be a monopoly. And what do we do about that middle ground? Which I think that's my thing for all of this is that like,
it's like
it doesn't fit the current models, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't figure out new models that do work.
I agree. I think the biggest problem is the word monopoly. And it's like, well, what the things that are bad about a monopoly are what power and anti-competitiveness, right? Or what if there's any other thing that add to that list, please do. But like clearly Amazon engages in a lot of anti-competitive practices, you know?
Yeah.
I think that needs to be kind of the focus of antitrust laws.
Yeah, and that's an interesting part there. I'm not a lawyer, very much not a lawyer, but my limited understanding of antitrust is that by and large in the US, it operates, or at least has in the last half century or whatever, operated off the idea of like the primary concern from antitrust perspective is consumer welfare. So is it harming customers? Yep. And typically that means, are you increasing prices? Either increasing prices or decreasing service, I think, are the sort of two poles of that operates under. Competing with, and so are the anti-competitiveness is under the lens of like, are you unfairly competing with other people, which then leads you to provide a worse outcome for customers, rather than I think Europe, I don't know. I think Europe has a little bit more of like, no, just being anti-competitive is wrong on its own terms, regardless of whether that means and so that's another interesting place where it's like, generally speaking, a lot of like, it's hard to say that like, well, how can something be anti-competitive in a consumer welfare sense when you are providing free things to customers? How could Facebook ever be doing something bad to customers when the product is free? And I think Europe or other standards that take more of a like, it kind of doesn't matter if the customer is harmed because we also need to care about our competitors harmed on their own sake, which, that's an interesting potential angle to poke at a little bit.
Yeah. Very interesting conversation, but also we're trying to talk about the next big thing.
I know. Maybe the next big thing, antitrust. All the all the kids are talking about. Anyway, general takeaway from that is, I think there is a pivot to that, is that I think a lot of the stuff that we were talking about, depending on how much survives the edit. A thread to all of that we were just talking about is that like there is this current stasis of technology companies that do seem to be dominated by these very large, very large tech platforms, internet platforms in the case of like a Google and a Facebook, like platforms in the case of also Google for Android, but Apple, Microsoft to a much lesser extent. And there's definitely, I think, undergirding a feeling of a lot of this, like, what is the next thing to happen in tech, is a sense of like, either what will continue or replace from this current ecosystem of these like big dominant platformy companies, but then also what can we do that could unseat one of these? I think this comes out a lot in some of the Web3 discussions around like, okay, what does it mean to have a decentralized social network or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, I think what happens is these big tech companies gobble up startups and, you know, force away innovation. But yeah, let's talk about Web3 and what that means. Because I have mixed feelings about it. It mainly seems just like a scammy buzzword that people are using to try and sell their crap to be like, hey, look, aren't we so different and unique? Aren't we? We're not one of the big tech people. We're trying to go away from this, you know, data sharing model that's infesting your lives sort of thing versus the utopian future of what the internet could be, you know?
Yeah. So keep me honest on this, but like bear and bull, bear is the good one, bull is the bad one.
I believe bear is bad.
The bull case then for Web3, or like the most charitable version of what people say when they talk about like Web3, caveat, not a monolith, and I'm sure everyone will come back and say, actually, my version of Web3 is 0.5% different than blah, blah, whatever. Anyway, the best general case that I've sort of seen around it is that like we both need to and people will want to move to a world in which like you get to own and control more of your data and your identity online. And one of the key tools that we will be able to do that is to move towards things that leverage blockchain and cryptocurrency and whatnot in order to be able to get to this world where like you can own your presence on the internet and it's a thing that you can transport portably between multiple different sort of decentralized services and kind of attempt to get this utopian vision of like, what was the internet before these big platforms came up? And we can do that by like giving you ownership of things, and blockchain can be the technology that enables us to say we can build platforms that don't require these centralized intermediaries. Is sort of my, I've always, spoiler, my problem with Web3 as a potential vision for the future is I've never been actually totally able to understand what is it that people are saying it will do and why is it going. But that's kind of the best I've been able to put together.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, that is the marketing for Web3, or that is utopian vision, you know? I don't think there is a single thing that is out there right now that has taken hold in any real fashion to be on that level or scale.
I mean, which I get the technological impulse to think that blockchains are cool, because the idea, the fundamental idea of like, hey, what if we could design trustless systems that are decentralized, that like there is a technological and a bit of a utopian appeal to that as a technology. It's just, I guess it's the, how does that apply to any actual use case in the real world? Other than what I will give some credit to is I do think that there are some elements of the cryptocurrency ecosystem that are logically coherent and consistent in terms of their philosophies and their worldviews and how they see cryptocurrency and blockchain technology coming into it, which is that they think the financial system is bad and they don't like a lot of the things that are necessary things that are part of the financial system. Like they don't like anti-money laundering laws and they don't like reversible transactions and they, like things that are not speaking for my employer, blah, 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 whatever, but I work in a like financial services company and like things that are expensive key parts of the financial industry that like most normal people do actually want. Like you want to be able to have chargebacks for your credit card so that if someone steals your credit card, you don't lose your money. And the government wants there to be anti-money laundering laws and know your customer laws to make sure that criminals aren't like sending a bunch of money for ransom payments and whatever. But I think there is a lot of the crypto ecosystem that thinks those are bad, and they have actually come up with a technology that does allow you to do the transfer of value part without having any of those benefits. And like, I'll at least give them that. Yeah, if you want to design money that can't be reversed and that is pseudonymous, then you have technically done that.
For better and worse, they have done that, which is cool and like definitely an impact on the world. I mean, I was talking to you, I don't know if this is before or after they started recording, but of how blockchain, you know, does have real uses. Did I say that on the recording already?
You mentioned it, yeah. I'm curious if there's any that come to mind, not in a like gotcha kind of way, but just a like, I have to imagine there are some, but I've not seen too many.
Yeah. I think most cryptocurrencies and NFTs, if not all, are scams, and like you should not it is not an investment vehicle to go into Bitcoin. The amount of also finance companies, especially like from China, I'm pretty sure, like, oh, they purposefully inflate the prices of Bitcoin to then sell off and just, you know, gassing the market. Like, what is that called? You know, the thing they did in Wolf of Wall Street, right?
Oh, where pump and dump?
Pump and dump happens all the time in the crypto world. Like, that's a very real thing. That's very bad.
One other that does remind me, there's a writer that I like who does a newsletter for Bloomberg, Matt Levine, that the newsletter is sort of, it's a very well-written stuff about like weird stuff in finance. So like he wrote a lot about when the GameStop stuff was going on or whatever. He wrote a full issue of Bloomberg that was on like, what is crypto? And he was coming at it from the perspective of like, crypto is weird, but like if you're someone who's interested in financial systems and financial puzzles, it's very interesting as like an intellectual thing to look at of like, oh, you've kind of invented the financial system in rapid succession in like 10 years, including all of the problems of the financial system that we solved over the last like several centuries around like pump and dumps or arguably like versions of the financial crisis happening in the crypto world right now, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. But there are, I know there was one guy who was talking about like, oh, real uses of blockchain that are kind of in this utopian Web3 sense of things of like, oh, we could, you know, have our own identities on the blockchain or like gaming skins that you could transfer from game to game, you know, like you make your own skin and because it'll slot into the blockchain in one game, it'll slot in another way to another game sort of thing. So you can own that thing. And it just felt like very utopian, high-flying dreams sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. That it's like, yeah, we have enough food in the world to feed everyone and solve world hunger. But guess what? We haven't, you know? It feels in that same way a lot of these blockchain utopia ideas are ignoring human behavior and like
that's where I think NFT is the one thing in the whole Web3 blockchain ecosystem that has been the most interesting to me and the one that I've come the closest to potentially seeing a utility. Now, a utility in the sense of like it's going to take over the world and be like the next Google? No. But a utility in the sense of like, I don't know, people like to spend money on dumb stuff and like entertainment is a real industry. Yeah. All the WeWork thing. Like renting office space is a real industry and can be a real business. It's just not going to be the next iPhone. And sort of similar thing with like the idea of in a world where people value scarcity and you move to digital stuff that inherently loses that scarcity. There is something interesting in coming up with a technological solution to reintroduce scarcity. And like, I can see niche value to that because human brains are human brains. And like, I don't know, it's more fun to buy the unique thing than it is to buy the generic thing.
I feel like that's bringing the worst aspects of like the art world. Online.
I guess I see it, that's a good point. The utopian part of the NFT world has always been a little bit more skeptical, whereas the crass part of the NFT world has
been more interesting.
But to the more utopian stuff of like, oh, you're able to use your skin across multiple different games and things like that. Yeah. It's like, that's interesting. There is reason for a small company to want to build in the interoperability with the big company, but there isn't any reason for the big company to want to expose that interoperability. So like, I don't see a world where that actually happens, which does get me thinking like, how much are we, is it kind of that we're just lucky that so much of the internet is standards-based? Like the fact, if email were coming around today, would email be an open protocol that anyone could build an email service and anyone could build an email app, RSS, HTTP, et cetera? Like, is it kind of just a fun accident of history that the internet is as standards-based as it is, given that it started as research projects and not nonprofit things?
I think that's one of the hugest problems right now is the monetization of any and everything that is going to be online. That's like, I don't know if there can be a next big thing when the first goal is going to be to monetize it, you know? Yeah, if email came out today, how much would it cost to subscribe to my email?
Like that said, what the counterpoint to that, or not counterpoint, but like the trade-off, I guess, inherent in that is that like IRC exists as like a method for doing real-time chat. It's like it's an open standard. Anyone can build an IRC client, anyone can build an IRC server, whatever. And Slack is a better experience. And the reason Slack is a better experience is because they own the whole thing and they can like move at a much greater speed than a standards-based thing can. They lose out on the fact that like in a standards-based thing, anyone can come up with ideas and the best one can win and eventually make it back into the standard and blah, blah, blah. But like iMessage is better than just using regular text. WhatsApp is better than that because like, I guess that is sort of the trade-off of like standardization opens one set of opportunities and closes another set, and centralization opens a set of opportunities and closes another set. And it's unclear. I think I feel very happy that like HTTP is a standard. That seems great. I don't know about email of like, would it actually be better? How would things be different if instead of there being whatever IMAP or whatever the email standards are, it was more proprietary? I don't know.
I have too much doubt in I maybe this is just, you know, again, my take against capitalism and how things have shook out over the past 40 years since Reagan. But it feels like we need social and structural change from there first, in order to prevent abuse of whatever the next big thing is, before that can come about, I guess. Sure. I don't know.
I can see that. Anything else on blockchain and Web3 other than it seems like a fairly resounding, and I think the market seems to at least currently agree that like, that's not the next big thing. That might be a next thing, but not the next big one. And probably most of what it is now is scammers and grifters.
I mean, I feel like Web3, the main conceit of it is, it is countering what I'm talking about of like, like the purpose of it is to kind of take down big tech companies, you know, and to be like, take the power out of their hands and into our own. And I just don't see innovation being the thing that does that. I see regulation being the thing that does that, I guess.
I think that makes sense. That's a good distinction of, Web3 as the goal of ownership and more decentralization, and separating that out from the, and the way we do it is blockchain.
Yeah. It's like, why would this pick up when big tech will slap it the fuck down?
To that end, a little bit of an interesting natural experiment in Elon Musk destroying Twitter and Mastodon getting a bump. I am on Mastodon. I have not tweeted in a while. I do still check it from time to time, but I've noticed a giant drop off in the number of people that I follow that post anymore. So it is becoming a ghost town. But Mastodon's interesting and it's fun and I like it. But yeah, a natural experiment in decentralization via competitive means as opposed to technological innovations or regulatory stuff.
Interesting. I have not been on Mastodon.
Let's go to, because I kind of want to save AI for last.
Okay.
But let's go to metaverse as another potential vision of the future. Certainly one that is most bought in by Meta, nay Facebook.
Yes.
To a lesser, well, allegedly then to a lesser extent by Microsoft and Apple, in that like Apple has their rumored AR headsets that are coming out this year and whatever. But
didn't Zuckerberg like publicly say it was a failure recently?
No.
I thought he said something.
There's been some stories around it talking about like, we have not been doing a good enough job of it. I think maybe talking about like some of our products have been failures, but not that the metaverse is one. And then I think also trying to assuage the Wall Street because Wall Street is a bunch of spooked children that like ignores the fact that like Facebook is actually doing just fine as a social network and an ad network. Like they've, sure. they've been, Facebook's problem is Apple doing the like app tracking transparency stuff, not yeah. that they're spending too much money on the metaverse because they're still spending like the problem with the, oh, Facebook's spending X billions of dollars on the metaverse is that they're still spending like single digit percentages of their revenue on the metaverse stuff. That's like, oh, they yeah. just make so much money that it's hard to conceptualize 10 billion means like whatever, 10% of yeah. revenue.
I mean, so anyway, I literally just Googled Mark Zuckerberg metaverse. And like the first article is like Mark Zuckerberg quietly buries the metaverse.
Yeah. No, that's not true. They did layoffs in some of the divisions, and he hasn't been talking about it as much on the investor calls. But like, they're still like they have a 5-year roadmap. They still are investing very heavily in it.
Interesting. Okay,
yeah, I think it's an investor relations move.
Gotcha. Cool. And trying to get just the PR of metaverse isn't a thing. Zuckerberg, stop trying to make it a thing.
Yeah.
Out of the discourse.
Yes. Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to be a thing.
Say more.
I mean, so first off, there's two metaverses. There's a capital M metaverse, TM, Facebook Meta, and then there is the metaverse that was popularized by some science fiction writer in like the, I want to say 70s or 80s.
Neal Stephenson, I believe.
Yes. Which I just think we're too far off. My roommate, this is a tangent that will make sense in a second. My roommate recently just got an emulator for Guitar Hero, and he bought a guitar from online for like $90-$100 or something. And music games have generally died out, maybe almost entirely died out since, you know, Guitar Hero 5, right? And Rock Band. And it's because there's a $90 to $100 side piece that you have to buy in order to play the game. Virtual reality headsets are nowhere as ubiquitous as iPhones or laptops or any other, you know, internet consuming device. And they are still very much just like trinkets to enjoy as opposed to, I don't know, crucial gaming systems to have, or even if not gaming systems, for other purposes as well.
Yeah.
I don't think we're just there yet. Maybe soon, but you know, several years away at the very least.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think it's unlike the Web3 example, or at least maybe the blockchain example is a better way of saying it. I can totally see a world, like I can picture why I would want a far future version of this, of like, if you're telling me that like I could like put on a lightweight helmet that work bought for me alongside my laptop, and I put it on and that puts me in a Zoom meeting that like looks like I'm at actually really looks like I'm talking to the person sitting at the desk next to me, like, yeah, okay, that'd be fun. I definitely, yeah, that's an improvement over Zoom. And especially if you're talking about like, oh, I could put
on the Jedi Council. Yes.
I could put on a normal pair of glasses that look just like totally normal glasses, and they give me like a screen, AR screen that lets me like see the turn by turn directions or translate things in real time or whatnot. Like in those worlds, I'm like, oh, 1,000%. I would gladly pay iPhone money for the glasses that are lightweight, battery life lasts all day, and provide that utility. We're nowhere near close to that yet. And so that's, I think, where I'm sort of in that, like, unlike the Web3 one, I can totally see if we can solve the technological problems, I can 1,000% see at least myself and presumably a lot of other people buying into this as the next computing platform, in the same way that like iPhones and smartphones become the next computing platform up from the desktop and laptops. Can we get to that point? Is the holy grail at the end of it going to be enough to get people to put in the amount of investment that it will take to get there?
Eventually, yes. But I see a path towards that as like a, you know, like, I feel like iPhones, the idea of an iPhone was, you know, a computer in your pocket. Like that existed in yeah. science fiction before. Like
totally.
most common themes in science fiction, I believe we will eventually get to them, you know, like if humanity keeps conceptualizing these things in our wildest dreams and fantasies, then we'll keep aiming for them, you know, versus yeah. Web3 definitely very much feels like a reaction to what's happening right now, you know?
Interesting. Like, I wouldn't say that way.
Yeah, yeah. Like Web3 is not an innovation unto itself. It is a reaction to, I don't know, loss of privacy, right? Or loss of ownership of self.
I like that. And it's interesting. From Facebook's perspective, I think you could argue that Facebook sees the metaverse as a reaction to what the current state of affairs, specifically the reaction to the current state where they are but an app on Apple's platform, and they don't get to like control the operating ecosystem. And you see that, like, okay, Apple changes a policy and they lose like 30% of their revenue and stuff like that. So I think that to me is why, part of why I think that Zuckerberg will have to be pushed out of the company before he'll give up his dream of like owning, being able to create a platform that becomes the next Apple, so that Facebook is independent of an Apple. And that's kind of why I think that like he's going to be in it for the long haul on the metaverse stuff. Which maybe ends up, again, stealing everything from Ben Thompson. It might be the case that like maybe Facebook burns billions and billions of dollars to do the crucial first 60% of the innovation that then another company gets to reap the spoils of. Like that's 1,000% possible. But, yeah,
which is fascinating because like that's great and fantastic and is purely just from the perspective of like a delusional man-child. Yeah. Like trying to will into existence his desires and whims.
Yeah. And I mean, to give him credit, like clearly the single biggest risk from a business perspective to Facebook is Apple. And so like, if they can do something to neutralize that risk, it's a moonshot, but like, I don't know, I can see the math working out. If your thought is like in 10 years, the company's going to be irrelevant. And so our choices are either build the next iPhone or die. I don't know.
Yeah, I can understand.
But yeah. I mean, I want my AR glasses that give me, although on the one hand, I want my AR glasses because those are cool. On the other hand, even as I'm saying that out loud, like the two examples I always think of are like, I want to be able to get directions and I want to have like real-time translation. And the real-time translation is cool. But also like, okay, now that I think about that, how often is that actually like, if those are the only two things that I'm thinking of that come to mind when I think of why would I want a computer strapped to my face, does that mean that I'm devoid of imagination and a much cooler thing will come out that like will actually make it the killer app for the AR glasses, for instance? Or does that mean that like, oh, maybe they actually are just peripherals to your point? Are they like more the fun? Are they more like the Apple Watch, I guess, is maybe a better thing. Like they are a useful peripheral to make your experience of using the iPhone better, or are they the next iPhone?
Yeah.
I don't know. I could kind of see it either way.
Yeah. I could see having a camera on your face could also be, you know, incredibly useful.
Yeah. I do think, I guess I am sort of intuitively bought in on the idea of like AR being more of the potential future platform and ubiquitous tool, and VR being more of the potential very useful and fun niche, but like maybe VR is the future of console video gaming, but that's again, like I've said many times, a very valid, important, useful business and a giant industry, not the iPhone.
Video games, I don't know. I might put video games on the level of.
Actually, that's maybe a better point. So I don't know the number of like iPhone sales or even all smartphone sales versus like video game consoles and video games, but maybe more accurately, like the iPhone and all of things that the iPhone enables in terms of like the mobile internet and mobile app ecosystem compared to.
You're right. I mean, just in general, no, not even in like hardware versus that thing, but in terms of like, oh, societal impact.
Yeah.
I would say, iPhone is probably one step or so, a couple of steps. I just don't want to sell video games short.
Oh, no, 1,000%. And then, like, which, again, Office Space, it's very valuable. It's a giant multi-billion-dollar industry. It's not a tech company.
Yeah.
Now, video games, that actually is a tech company. So that one, yes. I'll give them that. But okay. So Web3, interesting utopian ideal. I like your point of it being reactionary as opposed to actively
inspired.
Blockchain, useful technological or interesting technological tool. Whatever, take it or leave it. It's mostly grifters now, but maybe there's some interesting use cases.
Yeah.
Metaverse, cool. We want it. You see it in science fiction. It's definitely a thing that if we can solve the technological problems, will be great.
Yeah.
Hope it's not Facebook that does it. Hope that Facebook pours $1 billion into it and then some other company that's better than Facebook gets to reap the rewards.
I mean, Ready Player One, fantastic book and movie. And that is essentially the metaverse concept, which though, I mean, the whole point, at least in the, and the book as well, movie and book is of like, oh, there's the big bad corporation that is trying to take over the metaverse versus, you know, oh, there was this one genius guy who basically built it from scratch, which, you know, is very comparable to today's day and age of big corporation tech companies trying to ruin all of our fun. I'm bitter.
Yep. We love it. We love to see it. And then I guess the last one, and the one I wanted to say for last, is AI. Because arguably maybe that was the inception of like, oh, this could be a thing. Maybe it's just that it's like rule of threes, but like, seeing three different things that various people and seeing news trends about them and seeing like companies stake their livelihoods and stake their futures on that, like once the generative AI stuff starts popping up with the chatbot stuff that we talked about in a previous episode with Google and then the DALL-E image generation, OpenAI and Stable Diffusion stuff, the image generation stuff of like August-ish of last year. And then the ChatGPT and Bing chat stuff of earlier this winter, that like it definitely does seem like there's a whole lot of hype train going on. Like, how is AI gonna, and maybe specifically generative AI based on deep learning and blah, blah, blah. But like, I guess we could go specific or we could go broadly of like AI. Is that the next big thing?
I also do want to just especially given the nature of our podcast, explicitly define the differences between artificial intelligence in, you know, oh, as in life versus how it has been conceived of in recent, you know, how an artificial intelligence job, an AI job, what that looks like in a tech company today, you know?
Yeah. Which if you want to hear more about that, you can listen to my peak annoying episode, the question, can artificial intelligence be alive, from last year.
Didn't we have another one that was like something about electric sheep?
Oh, I'm sure we did at some point.
I'm sure. That's like bread and butter Wade and Whipple conversation.
Exactly.
but yeah, so we're not talking about robots coming around, which, by the way, robots, if you're listening to this, as you know, you've heard several times before, I welcome you as our new robot overlords. Thank you. But outside of that, I just got to say that every time it comes up, exactly, in case they're wondering, you know?
You got to get it down. Get it down on wax. Get it in the transcript.
Every chance I get. No, AI. So I know my company recently, actually my boss's boss, who's like also kind of my boss, is very involved with the team. He actually led a conversation in our company of us. So we have, I'm not going to name the title of it, but basically like, you eat lunch and then there's a presentation that's going on is what it's about.
Okay.
And this was it was probably our biggest one of like, it's a volunteer thing you can come and watch. This was the biggest one anyone had ever come to because it was about AI. And it was about, you know, describing what this new ChatGPT thing was, how, you know, it's going to affect people's jobs. And, you know, there's all the big questions that are asked of like, oh, is this going to take all of our jobs? And it's like, no, this is, you know, another tool that is going to assist in a lot of different situations. In the same way how spell check didn't take away editors' jobs, like this is not taking away your job, you know? And then also he specifically made some really cool stuff with ChatGPT, and like he started making a framework to try and like break ChatGPT to help him code for different things. And he posted this on the Discord, and then they the Discord mods deleted it because it was like, no, this is ruining our system. You are getting too much data from ChatGPT using this. We have our own corporate model coming out soon that you can purchase. And so don't use this other guy's free source one. Yeah, but ChatGPT is basically going to be this hugely influential thing and like can be this really cool tool that we can use in the future. So I know for coding, I know GitHub has like a GitHub Copilot thing that is – I have not used yet. I have access to it, I think, but I haven't used it yet. Yeah, I'm going to try to talk to my boss tomorrow about it, actually, see if I can use that. And yeah, it's basically like an assistant for your code. It's like a really smart person who's sitting next to you who doesn't know what to do. But if you ask them a specific question, they'll be like, oh, yeah, here's how you do X, Y, and Z. You can't give them like a set task to do sort of thing is how they described it. Yeah, that was kind of a bit rambly, but any thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I want to save it for last because this is the one that is the closest, like – If the Web3 stuff was like, eh, I don't buy it. And if the metaverse was, I'd love it. We're nowhere near close to it. This is the one, especially like seeing those Dolly demos and seeing those ChatGPT demos. I'm like, I mean, I could see this being quite useful in a lot of different ways potentially concerning ways in the like, even in that there's that spell check example of like, okay, you know, spell check, you're totally right. Did not, and or your boss who was giving the presentation, like totally right. It did not make editors out of the job. It just increased the productivity of everyone that was involved. The interesting one that I've seen a lot of people that are talking around, the like, oh, is ChatGPT going to like take journalists out of a job? Is DALL-E going to like take artists out of a job? I think I saw it like more with the DALL-E stuff weirdly than I did with the ChatGPT stuff. A thing that I have not, I don't think it's the same people that are saying both breathlessly, but I have not seen the same sort of thing around a genuinely cool and very inspiring story, which is that the probably at this point, I mean, certainly the episode's not going to come out until well after it, but I'm putting my money down. It is the favorite to be the Best Picture winner this weekend, Everything Ever All at Once.
Sure.
That they only had, I think, 5 VFX artists, and some of them were just part-time working on it. And most of them were like people who like got picked because they did like YouTube VFX stuff. So like they aren't professionals. And a lot of they've talked about and been interviewed, and I've heard interviews with people that founded a company that is like OpenAI and develops their own generative AI large language models and whatever for use in film production. And so they've talked about how like, oh yeah, the only reason we were able to do this movie on such a shoestring budget and with so few VFX artists is so much like grunt work got pushed out to these like AI tools that are able to like do compositing and help with the editing and like various other stuff that I don't understand, which on the one hand is very cool because like there's in the framing that I think is the most charitable, it's the like, well, a Disney is never a company that has hundreds of VFX artists. They're never going to make a movie like Everything Ever All at Once. It's only ever going to be made by little indie artists. And so giving them the tools to compete, great. On the other hand, there's the framing of it that's like, oh, so you're telling me that Disney could have 5 artists instead of 200 or however many they do? Awesome. Maybe they'll do that now. So like all of the challenge with the better the AI tools are and the more useful they are, then potentially the more damaging just from a like job automation thing, I guess. It is functionally no different than factory automation. Making factory workers out of a job. It's just now it's coming for what we think of as potentially a risk for what we think of as knowledge work as opposed to what we think of as blue collar work. But I don't know. It's,
yeah,
the better it is, and the more it is, it seems very related of like, it seems like there's a very strong correlated relationship between how useful it is and how potentially dangerous it is to existing jobs.
Yeah.
But maybe it's the kind of thing that, like, I don't know, it's like any automation conversation. Okay, well then get people to work on things that are, if it can be automated, then get people to work on more valuable stuff.
Yes. I don't know if I've probably mentioned this before in a previous AI episode. It just feels familiar, but of like the idea of plagiarism has been huge with this. So there was I want to say TechCrunch or maybe CNET.
I think it's.
Yes. Yeah. So CNET, they did an AI article that turns out was just plagiarizing everything. And, you know, you can't do that. That's not cool. But also at the same time, like, how far away from plagiarism can you get to break that barrier, right? Like, if you take something that's 99% the same, then okay, obviously you can't take that. What if it's 70% the same? And if there's a setting in these AI tools that, you know, beats plagiarism, is like the point of it. And there was this fantastic, like, there's an Instagram guy who, what he did is he took a specific artist's art, fed them all into an AI machine, and then started making different AI art. So it's like art that's made in the style of this artist.
Yeah.
But is that plagiarism? I would say in that case, yes. But that's a complicated question and answer.
Yeah. I get a little bit of a cheat code in that it's gut feeling. I haven't learned enough about the nuances to be able to like have a well-reasoned version of this. So I'll call out that it's just like, this is just my vibe. And so it might be totally wrong, but my intuitive vibe when it comes to everything around like intellectual property and what counts as plagiarism and what should be allowable copyright is pretty, I think, radically far on the bell curve of like, yeah, whatever, like let everyone copy whatever they want. Not all the way there, but like closer to there than I think the average person is, and probably closer to there than is actually true and reasonable. So like in that case, I'm like, oh, for me, I totally think like, no, it's not plagiarism at all. You're copying a style, whatever. Styles, anyone can do whatever they want with that. I hew a little bit more intuitively towards like, I guess in any intellectual property thing, the balance is between like, you want to reward the person who created the thing for creating the thing. And then you also want there to be the ability for society to take what was created and transform it and continue to create new things using things from the past. And I think my personal balance is one that like, I want to do the minimum viable amount of protecting the original creator and the maximum amount of allowing more transformation and future stuff. And I don't know exactly where that balance is, but I think my balance is not the normal, not on the norm. So in my case, I'm like, I mean, my real answer is like, give everyone a universal basic income and then like have no copyright protections is probably what I would actually want in the real world, but whatever. That's a fantasy version.
Wow. That's aggressive.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty far, I guess, on the side of anti copyright laws and IP stuff, but I don't know, independent, if I want to commission someone to make me a piece of art, like, and I can instead say, hey AI, here's their Instagram handle, make me something that has blues and greens and has a man picking his nose in it, that's kind of fucked up in my opinion.
I think it also sort of gets at the trickiness of this is a bit tangential, but it is going somewhere. In from half of an intellectual property Coursera course that I took once, so huge caveats, not a lawyer, didn't even finish the class.
Sure.
That generally there's like two different, if you're thinking about intellectual property, what you're doing is you're saying like, we're going to impose a new set of rules that is different than what just like the market would we're not going to let the market solve this. We're going to make there be some laws that say, no, here is a right that we're going to give the original creator. And if you're going to do that, you're going to like, well, you're doing it for a reason. Why do you think that it's so important that you need to write some laws that impose some intervention into the market? And the two general schools of thought for motivations for why you would do that is a like utilitarian version, which is we think that there is some societal benefit to giving people these copyright rights. So the and that's generally sort of what the US is based on. The Constitution literally says that like copyright is for the progress of science and useful arts or whatever. So like the US scheme is very like, we think that intellectual property is there for the purposes of trying to better society. And we think we can do that by giving rights to creators. Yeah. Another version of that is, I think it's called moral rights, but I could be getting that wrong, which is the idea of like, who cares about what's good for society? No, you created a thing. You just fundamentally, morally have a right to the thing that you created, regardless of whether that's what's good for society or not. That's just, there's right, there's wrong. And that's, this is right. This is, then this is wrong. And I think some of Europe, some European countries have more moral rights-based stuff. In a lot of cases, the two overlap.
Yeah, the results are the same.
Yeah, there's some little nuances of like U.S. patent law is actually a good example of something that isn't very moral rights-based, but is very utilitarian-based in how like the idea of a patent is that you have to you gain a monopoly over the thing you created for whatever, 20 years, but only if you agree to publish it publicly so everyone can learn from it. And like, that's an example of something that's more utilitarian and less moral rights based. But all of that is to say, in getting to that example of the like, oh, I want to commission an artist, or I can just go copy the art from a ChatGPT or a DALL-E thing or whatever. There's the utilitarian perspective is like the reason that is bad is because you are taking money away from the artist, and that's going to make it harder for the artist to live and harder for the artist to be able to make their art. And that's bad. And the moral rights version of it is the like, well, the artist came up with it. They are owed morally the fruits of their labor. They should get the money, not this AI thing. I think I basically just like don't agree with the moral rights thing at all. Like I have no sense of like there's any moral ownership for it. So that's an easy out for me. The utilitarian one is interesting. And like the cheat version of that is to say, this is why we should have universal basic income. And like that's a cheat because it's never going to happen. So I'm not interacting with the real world if I just say that that's my answer to it. Yeah. But if taking the real world as it is, then that poses that question of like, okay, well, so is the money that is going to the artist, is it for the fact that only the artist was technically able to create this thing? Or was it because only by getting it from the artist, you get the intangible benefits, consumer benefits of I bought an original thing as opposed to buying a generated copy? Or is it that the artist one is going to be better art than the version you get out of DALL-E? And like, depending on it sort of gets at the idea of like, where is the actual value exchange happening when you're trying to buy art from an artist? And the thing that the DALL-E is doing is saying it is now making it cheap or free to get something that is aesthetically similar. And so then it's like, is the only reason that you're doing it because of the aesthetics of it? In which case, yeah, totally right. Like, uh-oh, that's bad for the artist because the artist has nothing else
for
to
me,
serve.
Me personally, that's like what I would do. Like, I mean, I wouldn't morally do that, but I would, yes, I like buying pretty paintings, you know?
Ah, see, that's an interesting one because I think I would be, I think it would very much depend. If it was something that I was only getting because I liked the aesthetics of it, then like, probably yes. But I do have more of a like, I'm someone who is like, yes, I want to get this thing because it is a thing that represents a thing that I like, or like I'll, you know, buy paintings.
I mean, I guess like that, so. Both. I also enjoy that, but it's also maybe it's just because I lack a certain amount of paintings right now.
Sure.
I think someone described it the other day of like, oh, someone describing decor versus art. And I'm rolling my fucking eyes at what that is. So I guess, I think in my life right now, I don't have enough decor in my apartment. So I want prettier things.
So I guess I'll also say I know well enough to know that I'm not proposing that that is the take that normal people should have.
Sure.
No. It's interesting as an intellectual exercise, and I do believe it, but like
– there's also something to be said for the idea and then execution of that idea and how AI isn't creating ideas. It's only executing on pre-made ideas. And sure. There is nothing new quite yet that is being created by AI stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, all ideas are just copies of others' ideas. And like, I understand that concept, but also if you never had that original idea in the first place of that first artist whose Instagram handle you put in, then that other creation would have never come up in the first place. So that means that there was value to the idea, which I typically in most business ideas am fully of the opinion that idea is useless. It's the execution, except when it comes to art. That is my very big exception to that. Like,
sure.
Like execution, yes, is also important in art, but the idea is, you know, a major factor.
Yeah.
The important factor, the most important factor.
The other thing that sort of complicates all of this is there is sort of the couple different lenses of like who are the kind, especially since what we've seen now is like DALL-E especially is like creates visual art or images, I guess. And then ChatGPT can create text really well. And it's sort of at the point where there's the class of potential jobs that it obviates that are the very like, you wouldn't say they're art, probably, but they are like professional executions of we need text created or we need an image created. So like,
sure. Well, so that's
like
something specifically that my brother
and stuff like that.
That was something specifically my brother started to do. He wanted to make a startup for AI generated gaming assets.
Sure.
And you know, he made this really cool tool using the OpenAI system. I'm not fully sure. And like, it's a really cool thing. And it like creates like icons for like, oh, if you want a potion of swiftness, then it'll create a really cool icon for that. Or you know, you could type in anything and you can put in different models to create different themed stuff. It's like a really cool tool that 100% he could sell those assets or sell the tool to how to create the assets. And that would directly be imposing over the execution artists, I guess, is kind of what you were saying, right? Of you know,
yeah, and I think so. Where I'm sort of getting at with that is that like there's looking at the macro sense of like the economy overall of saying that like okay, let's say that the extreme case, DALL-E is good enough to replace 100% of corporate illustrations, and it can do it for 1% of the cost, and therefore we expect that all companies are going to switch to using DALL-E and no one's ever going to employ a corporate illustrator again. From a macro perspective, there's the like, that is bad for individual people who have to get new jobs, which is real. And like, I don't want to minimize that necessarily. But then there's also the like, oh, are we worse as a society if this thing that could be automated is now being automated and people are doing something else? Is that doesn't strike me as like worse from a society outside of the specific cost to people who are currently doing that as their job.
No, yeah. I mean, that's like the basic economics, right? Of, you know.
Yeah. In the art case. In the art case, there's the like, the one, I am not worried about it from the perspective of like, are people still going to create art or not? Because like, of course they will, because people create art for fun all the time, and that's fine.
Art is expression.
Yeah. But then there's the like professional art that is like that's that interesting thing of like, what happens to professional artists? And is it something that like, if it ever is good enough, is it something that like what professional art is you are actually now more paying for the fact that it was created by a human and the status associated with that? Or is it that I guess if we take the assumption case that like the AI will eventually be good enough that it is totally indistinguishable and as good by whatever subjective measures you take, and even as creative by whatever subjective measures you take as a human artist, in that case, is it that art continues to exist and it's just that what you're paying for is not the pure aesthetics and creativity, but something else ineffable? Is it that professional art doesn't really exist, but people just do it as hobbies? Is it that it's impossible for it to ever get that good?
I don't know. It's a scary question. As an artist, that is a scary question. Who's trying to make his career monetized.
That said, you have the benefit of working in a, on the theater side in particular, working in something that is deliberately tangible to a degree that on the one hand, limits its applicability. Like you lose out on the distribution benefits that you get from a like recorded thing that can be reproduced and distributed infinitely.
Sure.
But on the other hand, that means it is the thing that like AI is going to be much less likely to replace a theater actor than it would be to replace a film actor, because there is some, maybe that's a good example though of like theater is already a niche thing where what you're paying for is an aspect of the experience that is separate from the kinds of things that could be automated or digital.
Yes, but theater's dead, man. Okay, no one makes money off of theater.
Which I mean, is that maybe then what like art is that like does painting then exist as, or does digital art, or does film exist as a, there's a niche of people that do it human style and the rest of it gets automated? Or
it sounds like in the same way how, I mean, you know, this is kind of my opinion, but also not too much of like theater is dead and it's a lot harder to make your money and a career off of being a theater actor than it used to be.
Yeah.
Like that means there are a lot less theater actors and there are a lot less people who are trying to do that, because guess what? Monetarily, it is not something you can support yourself with unless you're on the upper echelons of theater. Yeah. And that is sad. That means there are less people striving to change and engage with this art form because you can't pay the bills with it.
Yeah.
Oh, this conversation got very sad for me specifically. Yeah.
No.
I think after having said just that, I mean, like I think then that AI art is going to directly impact those people. And like people are trying to make art their business and their livelihood, and they're not going to be able to afford to do that. Won't be able to do it as much. They won't be able to give themselves entirely to this craft. And that is sad.
Continuing the trio of everything that I ever think is just me stealing from Ben Thompson. One other thing that he does talk about, and this isn't been talking about like what we were talking about earlier on platforms, but like the fact that the internet means that anyone can distribute to anyone else. And now all of a sudden your competition is infinite as opposed to your competition being whoever was down in your town or whatever.
Sure.
Meaning that like that sort of tends to naturally divide into either you're one of the handful of superstars. In his case, he's talking about like writing on the internet. And it's like either you're the New York Times or you're the Washington Post, like the handful of giants. Or you're a bunch of like him, which is a one person blogging. Like he does make a very good living blogging about technology stuff. And like he wouldn't have been able to do that pre-internet. But like it sort of shifts into either you have really low overhead and you're doing something that's niche and that you can monetize enough to make a living off that, or you're doing something that's huge and everyone likes and then you can monetize off that. But everyone in the middle basically gets wiped out. There's no reason for, in the newspaper case, it's like, there's no reason for the Philadelphia Inquirer to have a Washington bureau anymore, because instead everyone treats the Washington Post. But there is a use for local Philly-based blogs that charge Philly people for Philly news. And so maybe that's a similar thing with art of like, you know, the challenge comes in things like theater or things like film that are inherently sort of expensive. Maybe film changes with AI tools, but whatever. That like in a world, do you see that same thing where it hollows out to either the giants and the micro budget? And if that happens, then does that suck?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I'm just getting sad for my career.
It's fine.
Alex, Wade, you gotta bring that extra special stuff that no AI could ever replace.
I have started to get into more live performance stuff lately, of like stand up, and then I'm trying to explore what that means for me outside of just like, oh, jokes and stuff, and you know.
Even the stand-up, though, did you see the ChatGPT-powered Infinite Seinfeld
Twitch
thing?
Did it get racist?
It got racist, yeah.
Of course it got racist.
Or transphobic, I think.
Sure, whatever. No, I'm not whatever, but it got bigoted was my general point.
Exactly. Don't worry. I'll edit that appropriately. Yeah. Anything else, I guess, on the future of the technology industry? I guess of any of those, do you?
I mean, I guess I would say AI, I think, is going to be a useful tool.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be iPhone.
Yeah. I think what I'm curious about is, regardless, I think, yeah, it's a useful tool. I think in terms of its broader impact, I primarily see its impact as being one on like the double-edged sword of it empowers people to do things they couldn't have done otherwise, and it also empowers companies to not pay people to do those things anymore. And in that world, there's either the world in which it doesn't have enough of an impact to cause any major job reshuffles, in which case, bummer, because we lose out on the power of it being impactful, but great, because yay jobs. Or there's the world in which it is devastating, but it's devastating to like a niche industry or a small industry or two, in which case my guess is probably that's just a like, oh no, bad for that industry, and the people that work in that become radicalized to some reactionary conservative group and we're sad. And then there's the world of which like it is completely devastating across the entirety of the knowledge economy, and I have no idea what happens in that world, because like at the end of the day, you do still need people in your country to make money, and the US is a knowledge and services based company now, and or country. Yeah. And like, I don't, what does a government do in the world in which AI obviates the need for knowledge workers, if it ever does?
Whew. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? God, fuck, man.
Well, if you want to train an AI to give you your own episodes of the ADUB Club that you can play in your blockchain-powered metaverse, you can listen to all of those episodes and feed them into your neural networks via the ADUB.club. That's THEADUB.CLUB. You can also hook that up to wherever fine podcasts are found, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that at theAWClub@gmail.com. That's THEAWCLUB@gmail.com. As of now, our Twitter account has not been banned by Elon Musk, but I also don't log on Twitter anymore. So don't bother tweeting at that, unless Alex really wants to use this as his time to like gear into Twitter as his new social platform. Of course, if you need to find out where to start with the podcast, you can do that at that aforementioned website, theadub.club, where you can see our topics and episodes guide, where we talk about all the different things, list out all the different things we talk about in various episodes, as well as our starter guide of some episodes that we think are great places to start if you want to. If this is your first episode, or if you want to point this towards other friends that want to get started. And with that, I think that is everything.
Okay, let's be clear. I'm down to be a human pet, you know? Edit that part out.
Good. Well done.
But